Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are in paper 52, section 4, which is old single column, page 594. Okay, so those two sections that as we've done over the last two sessions, took just that, two sessions. All right, the post-planetary prints and those and post-Adamic ages, there were lots and lots of very intriguing things they were throwing out. Got lots of thoughts going. Lots of contrast about how far removed from where we ought to be, you know, this world is. Remember some of the key points there that, you know, those ministers have such an impact that the humans really rise to the challenge of being human, you know, of not starting at their animal foundation and trying to desperately claw up the human nature like we tend to all do, but actually starting at your human foundation and beginning to build up from there, so that that spiritual consciousness, that relationship to unity that is yours by grace of being human and not merely animal, is your starting point, not your desperate hope that maybe someday, you know, you won't be just a hopeless, selfish blob of protoplasm, you know, and maybe you could have some spiritual consciousness every once in a while. But no, I mean, that's not your destiny, that's your origin as a human. Spiritual consciousness, you know, basic spiritual consciousness, a relationship to unity is the beginning of what you are by grace as a human. And normally, the prince and his staff and Adam and Eve, you know, are there on a world is a constant reminder of that. To start there, not start, you know, at trilobite and, you know, and try to get to human. But to start at human, and that's the big glaring issue. Everything that normally would happen if you start at the foundation of a human and work up from there hasn't really happened that much. We don't take delight in cultivating that basic integrity that is the foundational human. Our stories are all filled with drama, you know, of life as an animal, desperately hoping to, you know, to bring some humanity in, you know, into that animal pile, you know, the pile of monkeys, right? And it's just very unfortunate that that's, you know, and we call that dramatic, fancy animal. Well, we're only human. No, that's your only fancy animal, right? And it only takes a little bit of work, in relative terms. It takes hundreds of thousands of years, but you know, and in terms of your entire growth, it's a little bit of work. And that encouragement to be human and to build upon that foundation, really, there is no fear. There, we should be a people that not only now are one race, one language, but we should be a people that basically have completely mastered that, at least that most foundational element of your animal origin nature, the zeroth level of meaning, the level of fear, and you are the master of that. No longer does it control you. You control it. You use it as a technique of focus. Fear has been turned into focus. The exact same motion is in the mind, but it doesn't have those subsequent corollary emotions, you know, of completely discombobulating feelings, you know, and emotions. Right? Those don't happen anymore. You know, the basic focus energy without the emotional debris, you know, is now in your hands, and you use it to zero right in and to bring your cosmic intuitions right to that focus point that that adjutant mind, you know, produces, and you can get right to the point. You can penetrate through the fog and figure out what's really going on. You've got definitive insight, and you're exercising foresight, and you've got the courage to go through the tribulations of life that produce wisdom. You have wisdom, insight, and foresight, and you're the master of fear and becoming the master of more and more of your nature, you know, with each passing century of humans on the earth. But that's not here, right? But they are trying to encourage you, in contrast, to know that you don't have to go with the ignorance and the limitations of the main evolutionary stream. You don't have to accept that that's the way it has to be. You can begin to pull yourself out of that ignorant mass of humanity and take a hold of your genuine humanity. I mean, that's the main reason that they give us the life and teachings of Jesus. Of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. Now, why do they give you all those pages of that life? So you have a simple example of someone who was born in a lot more darkened space than you and I are born into, and he wasn't a victim of that, you know, because he knows he has free will. You know, you don't, and free will is control of your inner life, not the delusional thought that you have control of the outer life. The outer life is what it is. You can try to assert yourself on that outer life, and most of the time you lose, because there's forces that are greater than your self-assertion. You know, and that has nothing to do with free will, so just don't worry about it. Right? That's the way it is. You have to kind of go with the outer life flow as it is, but in the inner life you can begin to take on being a human despite those difficulties. And just remember, those difficulties are an opportunity for wisdom. The only way we can acquire wisdom is through tribulation. You can't just sit there and contemplate your navel and gain wisdom. You can only get it through tribulation. You have to have the courage. And so, you know, we can take on that challenge to have courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Right? What happens, you know, as subsequent to having that initial spiritual consciousness with the material consciousness that you have because of your animal origin nature? You put the two together and you get a super additive consequence. You get a cosmic consciousness, a budding, initial, genuine, human consciousness. And it grows ad infinitum, right? Until in eternity, you literally can have a relationship to infinity. That's a long way off. But it starts, you know, it can start genuinely here and now, despite the rebellion, despite the default, you know, despite the fact that my genetics is Swiss cheese, you know, and all these issues. I don't have to just be that lowest common denominator, which is so sad to record. All right, so we've swept through that, you know, and we saw all kinds of poignant things. You got to talk about genetics, and, you know, in a very upfront way. You can't be all delusional about that. We're animal origin creatures. There's genetic issues. You got to be able to talk about those honestly and fearlessly. And, you know, we went through that, you know, all the political correctness and the difficulty of that. But how did it end up? You know, just what transition are we moving into as we go into post-magisterial Son Man? Remember what they said right there in the next to the last paragraph in the previous section, right there in the middle of that, where they said the crowning development of this era, you know, the post-Adamic era, the crowning development of this era is the universal interest in intellectual realities, true philosophy. Right? That's what we saw. There's always been a little bit of a religious consciousness, a little bit of a religious nature. I mean, if nothing else, because the first and second epical revelations with the prince and his staff and Adam and Eve, you know, have encouraged. And it doesn't take much, you know, that relationship, genuine relationship to spirit substance, to unity, is a mustard seed. Just takes a little bit. You don't have to have anything very profound. So you've had that all along, and finally remember, with Adam and Eve, right, they bring science into full flower. And so you've got a genuine, full-on science, and you've got the mustard seed that you need of religion. And you put the two together, and you have the beginnings of true philosophy, or at least the pursuit towards true philosophy. You begin to have the recognition that that's a goal that you can now strive for, superadditively above science and religion. You know, and that's why the magisterial son comes. He comes as the philosophic uplifter. Now something is really going to get going with mankind, because you've gotten all of the rudimentary animal origin issues out of the way. You know, and a genuine human civilization can begin to flower. That's what we're looking at, and that happens through all of the individuals developing a personal living philosophy in their mind, developing that relationship, that synchronization with the cosmos, with the triunity, right? The individuality, associativity, and unity, together as one, encompassed by your personality as a triunity, a genuine philosophic mind, right? Not opinion, you know, and not ivy tower, you know, tangential speculation about nothing. And that's not philosophy. That's so-called philosophy, genuine philosophy. And that's what you're quivering on the very brink of, is an individual coming to foster that full flower of a philosophic people, so that there can be civilization in full flower. Neither science nor religion can produce the fullness of civilization. They're parts. Philosophy is a relationship to the whole, a relationship to truth, not just fact, right? And you know, or just goodness, right? It's not just fact or goodness, or one or the other. Right? Two together is one, and the wholeness of truth. And in that truth, which you can obey, right? You can't obey fact. You can't even obey goodness. You can only obey truth. You have to have the truth in order for mankind to really begin to march as one, a collection of kindred minds towards great destinies. And that's what the magisterial son comes to inaugurate, the beginning of that holistic functioning of mankind. You know, often the basic aspect of, you know, we'll imagine and call the brotherhood of man. All right, so let's see what they have to say here for us.
Number four, post-magisterial son man. On normal and loyal planets, this age opens with the mortal races blended and biologically fit. There are no race or color problems. Literally all nations and races are of one blood. The brotherhood of man flourishes, and the nations are learning to live on earth in peace and tranquility. Such a world stands on the eve of a great and culminating intellectual development.
You can just say, I kind of just talked about all that already, but just, you know, notice what they say in the first sentence. You've got it all blended. You know, Adam and Eve have seen to the proper blending, and you know, and the fading away of the really defective strains, so that they aren't, you know, you can have a more systematic functioning of mind in every individual. You don't have this Swiss cheese foundation, you know. So in terms of just that, you know, what they mean by this, you know, that they're biologically fit, quote unquote. Not in some absolute sense, but in terms of anything that we can imagine right now of how we're biologically unfit, that is no longer the case. there's subtler things. There's subtler things that we can't even really appreciate right now, because there's no way to even appreciate that there's these subtler differentials in the midst of these very coarse, huge issues that we have right now genetically. Right? But if you get rid of all those, right, those finer issues will be dealt with continuing going forward. But all the rudimentary, like I said, really kind of animal origin, up from the bottom issues have been dealt with. Now it's just a matter of the remaining issues are about improving how well you can synchronize with the cosmos, how well you can synchronize with the universal unity, not how well you just stand as a foundation. Foundation is fit. And now you're going to work on improving what you build upon that foundation as a human, you know, actual human development in contrast to the animal development of humans. Yep.
So they use the expression blood all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And is that, you know, figuratively like you would think?
Right. I mean, they do that, remember, for one reason. They want to remind you that there is a parallel of truth in those statements in the Bible, you know, that speak that way. And, of course, the Bible speaks that way because humans have always spoken that way.
Okay. There's not a literal aspect.
Right, right now, yeah, I mean, don't go into all the magical notions about blood that humans have always had, of course.
So when it says all nations and all races are of one blood, is that basically there's an amalgamation and everybody's...
All six races have been blended together with the Adamic race, the violet race, and you know, and they're all together now as one race. And remember again, because the book is always constructed evolutionally. You know, it's not an evolutionary fact. This thing didn't evolve. It was constructed, but it's constructed to be evolutional, to synchronize with us evolutionarily. So the way we've used words, they use those as much as they can, without forcing us to do something that seems too arbitrary, you know. And so, like when they coined this, the term sangic, right? I mean, sang, okay, blood, right? I mean, for the same reason, right? I mean, they just coined that word like that so that, you know, it's in the IK suffix is the Sanskrit agentive suffix, you know, meaning producing. So it's, you know, bloodline producing is what sangic literally means.
But this leads me to what, you know, you said this the other day, is that maybe it may be a couple hundred years, but it seems that if that's the case, I mean, it's going to be hard for that to happen on this world.
Right.
For in any reasonable period of time.
Right.
Before
right.
Perhaps a magisterial sun might come, I don't know.
Well, I mean, the magisterial sun wouldn't deal with that issue. That's, you know, the issue of someone, like if Machaventa finally decides that he's going to go ahead and assume his full role as planetary prince, right, if he's actually going to do that at some point, you know, some relativists think, well, he'll probably also assume the role as quote-unquote material son. As overseer of the biologic issues that normally Adam and Eve oversee, right, help us with, you know, with all these issues of that thing, that term that we can't even talk about, eugenics.
Still would take a, right? Take a while.
But eugenics needs to be well. You know, just remember the EU prefix means well, right? You know, do you want your genetics to be well or not, right? I mean, we shouldn't be afraid of that term. I mean, it's the truth. And there needs to be someone to help us with that. And, you know, there's going to be all kinds of genetic engineering that's going to be required to deal with this. You know, we know we can't just blend the races we've got now. There's way too much defective strains. You just completely collapse the whole thing if you just blend it all willy-nilly right now. There's all kinds of wisdom that we need help with, and how you blend, when you blend, over how a span of time, you know, and who should be reproducing more or less or not at all, and all these issues. We need some help with all that.
But you may not have to necessarily get to that point in this particular world like you would in others before the magisterial sun may come, only because of the fact that, you know, we're not starting out with the same, you know, game plan.
Yeah.
In other words, ours is pretty much thrown out the window.
Right. I mean, so that, obviously what's going to happen here is you're going to start working on the higher things that you can do despite the limited biologic foundation. Because there are many things that could be done despite that. That's why they say in Paper 16, Section 6, it's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch take delight in cultivating. Right? Why is it sad? It's not sad because, oh, you poor people, you had a rebellion and default, and it's just hopeless, there's nothing you can do. That's not the sadness. The sadness is that there's so many things you could do despite these issues. And we can be guided as individuals and as a whole people, as a world, forward with all the things that we can do while there's this long process of slowly improving the genetic issues and, you know, getting us blended together and you know, getting to the point of one language and eventually one religion, one true religion instead of, you know, an almost endless number of false ones, and these sorts of things. Yeah. All right. Okay. Let's see. So that basic issue of, like I was saying, that so all the things that we can really imagine right now that would be problematic to visualizing this world being settled in light and life eventually, those are all off the table. And it all becomes kind of abstract from this point on, really, for us to try to imagine exactly what's going on, because it's really kind of beyond anything that we have any familiarity with, right? But you get the basic idea. You'll see how they sort of just give you the essence that you can at least appreciate there's a sequence, even if the sequence of improvement is a little bit abstract and beyond your immediate ability to get your mind wrapped around, okay? All right, so let's get into specifics here.
When an evolutionary world becomes thus ripe for the magisterial age, one of the high order of Avenal sons makes his appearance on a magisterial mission. The planetary prince and the material sons are of local universe origin. The magisterial son hails from paradise.
Right, so what's that one little paragraph about? They're trying to get you to reflect on, you know, the etymology of the word magisterial, right? The literalness of why did they, you know, decide to call them that in English? I mean, you've got that, you know, it's tied back to the word master, right? I mean, like, you know, why did they call Jesus master? Because, you know, he was an expression of self-mastery, right? And, you know, that kind of holistic philosophic over-control of his self, that wise, insightful sort of nature. Plus, you know, the word magisterial has that very strong authoritative, you know, sense to it, right? I mean, so let it be written, so let it be done, you know? Very definitive. You know, what does it remind you that the purpose of this revelation is to give us that better set of initial assumptions that allow you to begin to proceed forward in truth rather than in falsehood like we are now. You know, and hence, it's the authoritative elimination of error. Right? And, you know, we always reflect on how this is, you know, this special epical revelation, not a dispensational one, was given to us, presaging most likely the coming of the magisterial son in the not too distant future, to begin to pick up where we've left off. Right? It's the authoritative elimination of error, just like he's the authoritative elimination of error. Error is in contrast to truth. Philosophy is about truth. Right? This is a philosophic text. He comes as the philosophic uplifter. Right, so that's what they're wanting you to see. It's not local, right? He comes from the center of all things and beings. Authoritative elimination of error. Not relative, you know, like a magisterial son, a Melchizedek son, in contrast to a magisterial son, you know, is a pretty decent source for eliminating error. But remember, they're not absolute in that regard. They occasionally can have a little blind spot. Right? Not to the point of evil, but error, right? There can be error. There can be unwise judgment. not mistaken judgment, but there can be unwise judgment, and there can be a little wisdom deficit. They're still acquiring wisdom like we are. But you get a magisterial son, okay, there's no issue like that. There's no blind spots. Right? They're authoritative elimination of error. They can give you definitively, this is the starting point that you want. This is the initial assumption you want. And you don't have to wonder, it's like, well, is this going to get appealed? You know, is a Verondadex son going to step in and say, well, no, actually? No, there's not going to be any issue like that. Yep.
Would the magisterial son come in flesh and blood?
Right, yeah, they're just about to mention that. Yeah, they're just about to mention that. And remember, the first time, there may be multiple magisterial missions. First one is always corporeal, right? The first one, the being incarnates. And the 12 Melchizedeks that come as his assistants, right, will also manifest materially. You know, they don't have to incarnate, remember, to manifest materially. Right? But it's important, and we'll get to that as we go forward. Remember, the magisterial son is incarnated. Right? So he's going to be, a lot like us in many ways. Right? In the sense of, he's going to be like the potential of us in many ways. Okay. Lest you misunderstand. right? I mean, he's going to have an adjuster, right? In his mind, like we do. And there's going to be a soul, right? And I mean, when you incarnate, remember, that's the whole point, is that you're actually having a mind that's not unlike ours. See, that an adjuster indwells, and there's hence a soul and all the consequences of that. Okay, so there's a human likeness, right? I mean, they are taking on, they're definitely coming down from on high, but they're incarnated and taking on that up from the humus, that bottom up human nature. All right, so the two are together as one when they're incarnated, but they're not being born as a babe, right? They're like Machaventa, in 1980 BC, right? Yeah. Being incarnated as an adult. Right. Okay.
When the Paradise Evanals come to the mortal spheres on judicial actions solely as dispensation adjudicators, they are never incarnated. But when they come on magisterial missions, at least the initial one, they are always incarnated. Though they do not experience birth, neither do they die the death of the realm. They may live on for generations in those cases where they remain as rulers on certain planets. When their missions are concluded, they yield up their planetary lives and return to their former status of divine sonship.
Yeah, just like Machaventa, eventually ended his time, and they just basically unplug him out of that. But, there's a bit of quote-unquote there that they didn't give you literally. Their former status of divine sonship. Well, yes and no, right? Because they're never the same after, being descending son is ever the same after an incarnation, because there's a soul that fuses with them.
I've thought about that.
Right? Right?
Don't forget. Didn't have before.
Right.
Necessarily.
Right. So, remember, we talked about that. Back when we were going, the worlds around Salvington, around the local universe headquarters. Right? And, there's 10 groups of 7 worlds, because remember, there's 70 primary satellites around it in the string of pearls. Right, and each 7, right, is a group around the string of pearls, and remember how they started with the 7 Melchizedek worlds, and we kept chugging around, and we got to the 9 worlds of the Seraphim, and we're waiting for in the next paper or something to tell us about the 10th group, and they never did. Right, we noticed that the next after the seraphim, they were talking about ascending suns, but there was no mention anywhere of, you know, you're left wondering, like, well, what are those other set? What's the tenth set of worlds about? Whose headquarters is that? Remember, and we were putting two and two together. There's a special type of quote-unquote ascending sun, if you will. Right? It's not ascending mortals, because, you know, remember, there was a set of worlds for us to be headquartered there. Right? You put two and two together, it's like, oh, I'll bet you those are the worlds of the magisterial sons, see, post-incarnation. Because they're now part of... You know, once, like, when they're in this local universe, when they're in Nebadon, when they're incarnated in Nebadon, they've become part of the evolutionary phenomenon of this local universe. You know, and they have an ascending portion of them, that soul that is fused with their, you know, that with their spirit-like energy nature, right? It has changed them forevermore, you know, and given them an ascending part to complement their initially all descending nature, right? And
it must have happened to Jesus too,
though. Right. Yeah, but of course he's, you know, a little bit different, you know, because he's a creator son. But anyway, that you want to definitely remember that that's a very important thing, that it's not just when magisterial sons serve as bestowal sons, but when they're serving as magisterial sons directly. That there is a soul involved, and hence there's a change. And I think I even put a bookmark in there to, in case this came up. You know, up there when they're talking about the time in the tomb, you know, with Jesus. What paper is that? That's paper 188 in section 3. You know, they make that comment. They're trying to, you have all these different speculations about, you know, exactly how it works with the Creator Son by different revelators speculating. And one of them says, well, you know, I think it has something to do with, they don't explain, but they call it the Nebadon core of the finality. Right? And you put two and two together again. Okay, I think it's going to be something like the magisterial sons. And won't he kind of like be the leader of all those magisterial sons post-incarnations? Because he's kind of like them, like you were saying, you know, so there's a speculation along that line, see? Right, see that, you know, I'm pretty sure the tenth set of worlds is for the Nebadon core of the finality, right? That you don't finally get mentioned until almost till the end of the book up there, you know? All right, so remember that's happening because they're, at least their first time, they're incarnated, and so unlike a creator son, they have many times they'll be incarnated. So there's this very strange thing where there's many souls that merge into their nature. They have all
a different adjuster each time.
And a different adjuster each time, see. And right, and of course they can't fuse with the adjuster, right? The soul doesn't fuse with the adjuster. The soul fuses with their nature, just like it did with Jesus. His quote-unquote fusion spirit. Jesus has this part of him that a soul can fuse to. Michael has this part of him that, you know, that a soul can fuse to. Right, so they've got, obviously have the same sort of a thing, you've got that whole very interesting, mysterious thing happening. Okay, let's see, anything else there? Just remember, you know, like I said, these magisterial sons or these avonal sons, you know, have three different things they do. They're always overseeing the dispensational adjudications, the judicial actions.
Soul brothers.
Right, and then there's and they're soul brothers, and then there's the all these magisterial missions, and then we'll get to the next section about a bestowal son mission. And just like Machaventa, as they're describing, yeah, had neither father nor mother, right? Yeah, they're not born a babe. They're just, you know, a body is constructed, just like, you know, was constructed for Machaventa Melchizedek, or just was constructed for the prince's staff. Right? A corporeal body is built, you know, and their energy system synchronizes with that energy system. The two energy systems, you know, work together as one. All right. You know, I mean, they're two bodies, right? Magisterial son has a body, it's just not a flesh and blood body normally. So he's incarnated, then he also has a flesh and blood body. One more thing to say on that. Remember, this it reminds you, we were talking about this before, we're a downstepped expression in terms of our morphology of beings on high. Remember we talked about with Melchizedek, it's very obvious that, if a Melchizedek is, in this one sense, is quote-unquote high spiritual being, well, yes and no, he has this variability of how his energy system manifests, his body manifests, and he can literally manifest like to look like me, and he's just like me. He's got all the plumbing and all the parts. Okay? He can literally function sexually, as a Melchizedek life carrier. And the fact that it's that like that, that's why a being can incarnate. Right, the energy systems match up in great detail. You basically just have, this kind of energy body is just a downstepped expression of other types of energy bodies, and it's in a local universe. You really have kind of just one kind of being expressed at various levels, and we're down at the lowest level, right? And so these beings, all they have to do is just have that higher nature just synchronized with its shadow, if you will, on a lower level, and they match right up, part for part. And so, it's just directly understandable. There isn't some magical sort of, mist being, inhabiting a body or something. You're just literally aligning the energy systems. The arm goes with, their right arm goes with the corporeal right arm, and their left arm goes with the corporeal left arm, and et cetera. Yeah. Okay.
Each new dispensation extends the horizon of revealed religion, and the magisterial sons extend the revelation of truth to portray the affairs of the local universe and all its tributaries.
Yeah, so that one little tidbit, as we were saying, these previous two. First, it's revealed up to the local system level, and they give them a whole world view that's kind of just provincial like that, if you will, very local, very limited, but true. And then they notch it up to the constellation level, and now in the third one here, they notch it up to the whole local universe level. And they never really explain, but in some basic way, they're basically just kind of letting the people at this level think that the Creator Son is God, is the Universal Father. However, unlike, letting them kind of think that the System Sovereign was the Universal Father, and then the Constellation Father is the Universal Father, when you get up to this level, right, there's two now, right? There's the Creative Mother Spirit also. So just think about that. See, when you get to the magisterial son level, when you get to the magisterial son age, post-magisterial son age, because they've got a pair, for the first time, they can give them a worldview that's more complete, where there's actually two parents instead of just one parent. Yeah. Because obviously, if you're really going to get into philosophy here, at some point, everyone's going to be going, well, wait a minute. I had two biologic parents. That has to be a downstepped expression of something on high. It'll finally start to sink in when you get philosophy going and logic going that having just one parent doesn't make any sense. Right? They can't just be the Universal Father. There must be another parent. Right? So you've had epical revelations of the Father in the by the first two administrations, you'll now have the third epical revelation of the Father and the first epical revelation of the Mother in the post-magisterial Son Age, because it's just right there with the downstepped expression of that duality in the Creator Son and the Creative Mother Spirit at the local universe level.
We have it here.
Right. Again, is this not obviously presaging the magisterial Son coming? Right, like I said, this is the fifth epical revelation of God the Father. It's the first epical revelation of God the Mother. Right? For the first time, you're allowed to have a big enough picture where you can figure that out. Right? You've been told about the individuality of the parts. God the Father. For the first time, you can begin to wrap your mind around the big picture and understand there's a whole, not just a bunch of parts rattling around. There's a whole, and there's an individuality of that whole. There is God the Mother. Something that you can't really understand as an anthropomorphic extrapolation. Right? Extrapolating Adam into Osiris, you know, into God or something. Okay, there's a measure of truth there. But extrapolating Eve into, no, it doesn't work that way. Eve is a part. Like Adam is a part. Right? That's why, you know, they collectively are called atoms or, you know, material suns. Right, the first whole is the first time as you're moving up the hierarchy, you get a universe, a one turning, the local universe. That's the first presence of the ubiquity of Mother Deity. Right. So that's a very important thing to see between the lines there.
You're saying this doesn't normally happen until that particular time, and yet we're learning about it.
Right. See, so fascinating. Right. Again, so you can see how, you know, that's also part of how they're filling in. You know, we haven't gotten the magisterial sign yet, but we have seen something that's foreshadowing it, definitely. Or
even Jesus.
Right. I mean, yeah. See, you know, remember, you know, technically as a bestowal son, he would be revealing this up to the super universe, so he'd be talking about the Ancients of Days, right? You know, the super fathers. Now there is a mother part there to the super universe too, but remember, he didn't actually do that because he was jumping ahead, right? So he kept it at, you know, calling God the Most High, you know, in the post-Adamic age. Effectively, it's the constellation Father still. But anyway, back to the normal thing. So you can just see how, again, like I said, we're going to get genuine logic, genuine true philosophy in play. And there's no way that you can construct a logical reality, picture of reality, with only one parent, with only God the Father. That's just inherently illogical. Right? Otherwise, there would be only males in this room. And not a lot of them, because where would any procreation come from? Right? There would be one male, very old male, sitting in this room, right? Right. I mean, right. So, see, at this point, you know, you begin to really give, you know, like we talked about, normally you have these you know, people on a world are all in a very narrow bell curve. They aren't spread out like we are. And they're being moved along very methodically. All right, and you get to this point, and you kind of open up the universe a little more definitively for them. They've been kept in kind of a small space up to this point. But now it's time to kind of open things up, get a bigger picture. Right, because there's no way that you're going to get them synchronized with the whole, with truth, in some little circumscribed space. You got to give them something that's more genuinely the big picture. All right.
After the initial visitation of the magisterial son, the races soon effect their economic liberation. The daily work required to sustain one's independence would be represented by 2.5 hours of your time. It is perfectly safe to liberate such ethical and intelligent mortals. Such refined peoples well know how to utilize leisure for self-improvement and planetary advancement. This age witnesses the further purification of the racial stocks by the restriction of reproduction among the less fit and poorly endowed individuals.
So let's deal with that last part first. So there's that relativity. I mean, you know, and this greater lesser is completely beyond our appreciation here. I mean, you know, the least of these people at this point, you know, we would think of as some perfect being, right? Right? Some being with no ability to be affected by any bacterial or viral diseases, you know, perfect form and, you know, everything. But, you know, you're into the subtleties now. And there is always a greater lesser. And, you know, notice how they say the restriction, right? So they're just going to begin this, you know, this imposition, and it's self-imposed, right? Everyone has the wisdom to recognize this, and they impose this upon themselves, you know, of those who genetically got a little bit of cut above others, you know, you let them reproduce a little bit more than the less fit. Right, so and that goes all the way on into light and life. You know, that's sort of discrimination. You know, between you know, the human quality in contrast to the animal quality. All right. Okay, so you got these things. So the daily work required to sustain one's independence would be represented as 2 to 2.5 hours of your time. Okay, what's between the lines? Why is this happening?
Because it takes that long just to get to and get from work.
right now it takes that long to just to commute. and it's like, you know, maybe that's not very wise. Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, that's, see, what's going on here, right? See, wisdom. You know, you actually have enough wisdom in the individuals that's beginning to be socialized, right, and institutionalized, right, so that everyone is functioning much more wisely. There's almost no wisdom in our institutions and human constructs right now. They're just kind of these haphazard things, right, that have all kinds of bureaucratic overload on them and everything, right? But you're beginning to produce much more efficient living because of your wisdom and your insight and your foresight that you didn't have before, and that we desperately need right now. You know, and notice that it is perfectly safe. Right? We have to all humbly recognize this about ourselves, right? It's really not safe for me to have too much time on my hands.
I've noticed that. Say that one more time.
It's and humans have long, you know, reflectively recognized this. We have sayings like, you know, idle hands are the devil's workshop, you know, and right, things like that. Right. We basically understand this, right? That you know, in many ways what the world needs is more indentured servitude. Right? One of the problems we've got is we've got a lot of people have way too much free time on their hands for the amount of wisdom, insight, and foresight that's going on between their ears. Right? They, you know, that liberation from drudgery that they got, you know, maybe because they, you know, of just the luck of fortune or whatever, you know, is not used productively. Right? They become a burden on civilization, not a light. You know, and right, so that they're reminding you that's, yeah. So before this time, the planetary government, you know, would be keeping everyone busy and stuff a lot, right? I mean, and it's only now they're going to start to let things up, and people can, because you need free time to really develop personally, right? When your nose is to the grindstone, you're a fancy machine. Right? You're not a person. So you need to start to have that. But if you're given...
That's important, what you're saying.
Yeah. Even in our state. Yes. I mean, those who have the potential to do more than just kind of a worker drone sort of a role in our civilization need to be given the ability, and they have to find the recognition of personal responsibility and the exercise of self-control. But they need to be given, you know, the liberty to pursue things beyond just the day-to-day grunge. Yeah, I mean, if we don't allow that, I mean, we're never going to go forward, right? Who's going to, if we don't let the leaders blossom, how, you know, who's going to lead us forward? So that has to occur. And, you know, I mean, historically, you know, like, why did Isaac Newton, you know, why was he able to do the things that he did? It's not just because he was intelligent. It's because he was independently wealthy, right? If he wasn't born independently wealthy, we wouldn't know Isaac Newton's name. You know, he would have lived and died with his nose to a grindstone somewhere, just like the countless Isaac Newtons that no one knows that lived for millennia before him that never had a chance to blossom because, right, there wasn't an opportunity. If you weren't spending all day trying to kill a, you know, some large lumbering animal, you know, you'd starve to death. There wasn't time for sitting there contemplating philosophical, you know, subtleties. So, it's very important that that be there. See, in order for this philosophic age to blossom, and fortunately, all of the precursors are in place so that when you give people liberty, it's true liberty and not false liberty, right? And that's what we unfortunately have on this world, right? Is that manifestation of the rebellion, you know? That's the basic element of the rebellion, giving people liberty before they're ready to handle it. And you don't get true liberty. You get false liberty, and you get self-destruction, right? You're your own worst enemy. You don't have the wisdom, insight, and foresight to manifest true liberty. It's always going to be false liberty, and you'll destroy yourself and everyone else in the process in that so-called liberty. The people's well know. See, you know, using that word well, right, indicating a relation to the whole. Self-improvement and planetary advancement. All right. Okay, let's keep going.
The political, government, and social administration of the races continue to improve. Self-government being fairly well established by the end of this age. By self-government, we refer to the highest type of representative government. Such worlds advance and honor only those leaders and rulers who are most fit to bear social and political responsibilities.
Not more fit, most fit. Because remember, you're talking about that never more than 1%, right, that have the ability to be genuine leaders in any generation. Right, so by self-government, they mean representative government. And of course, just a little aside, you know, when you go through the civilization papers, they talk about this. You know, remember, it took a long time, but finally lots of gentle fostering and over-control got representative government to begin to manifest on this planet. You know, that's as above, so below. That's a manifestation of a high ideal of government to finally begin to manifest on this planet. You know, that very definitive, for the first time, the United States, you've got the three branches, right, on high, expressed below. Took a long time for evolution to achieve what normally revelation would have achieved long ago. Right, we would have been directly fostered into that a long ago, but that which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution always achieves. So, slowly over time, it finally came to pass. It's not an accident that the United States came into existence. It's that little spear point of bringing that above, below for the first time, and it's a very tenuous light in the darkness. Of 200,000 years of rebellion and default, as Abraham Lincoln knew, right, at the end of the Gettysburg Address. He knew that intuitively, that, if this light goes out, well, then what, right? Europe struggles still, right? Just very tentatively holding on to some measure of democracy. They can't really get themselves out of the tribal state to an actual nation state, you know, status. You know, they still have to have parliamentary government, you know, which is what you need in order to have democracy when you still are too stuck in tribal mode. We just don't want to ever forget that we do have some shades of what goes on in a post-magisterial sun age. It was very carefully nurtured into existence you know, and it's and it should be cherished and maintained very vigorously. There's a duty that we have to keep the light going in the darkness, and to not fall victim to the sophistries of going back to the hoard. You see how, you know, they said self-government, because you start with the unity consciousness, like I said, that foundation of human nature, that initial unity consciousness manifests as the hoard, where everyone thinks of themselves as identical. Yeah, they're all quote-unquote born equal, right, as just cogs in a hoard. They're a collective. There's no individuality. And we've been journeying upward from that, for a million years. And we finally now, for a few hundred years, have had the beginnings of some, definitive enough individuation. The law is written enough in individuals' hearts, right? That's the whole point of the United States, this experiment. Are we integrous enough internally now that we don't need to have just endless imposition externally on us in order for it to be safe, as they said here? Right? And that's the whole experiment. Can we take off most of the external constraints and assume the integrity within? That's the great experiment. It's beginning to fail. That's why this book is in my lap. Part of the emergency. And we're losing that. We're starting to believe that unity is our destiny rather than our origin. And we want to be horde-like again. Instead of challenging to be more cosmically individuated. And it begins with a family. And builds from there. Right, and we're de-familyizing, we're de-individuating. So you can see that very definitely there. That's why they're emphasizing that, reminding you that that's the sequence here. You're building up to that cosmic individuality that you have when you leave Gerasim. And that's what the whole life on your mortal sphere is about, trying to do the beginning stages of what you do on the mansion worlds up to Gerasim. At getting that genuine cosmic individuation. Not the apparent individuation of animal origin, right? Biologic separateness. Representative government. All right, let's keep going.
During this epoch, the majority of the world mortals are adjuster and dwelt. But even yet, the bestowal of divine monitors is not always universal. The adjusters of fusion destiny are not yet bestowed upon all planetary mortals. It is still necessary for the will creatures to choose the mystery monitors.
Okay, this is, again, I give these little tidbits.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Remember, we'll get to, when we eventually get to the Light and Life paper here, remember, I often point to that startling statement there. Now, finally, more people are reaching third circle or during their mortal life. You're going, really? Right? They're like perfect beyond our wildest imaginations. They're living 500 years, and they're just more and more getting to third circler. Right, see, here's the beginnings of that sort of a statement. During this epoch, the majority of the world mortals are adjuster and dwell. Right. And this is on a normal world. Right. So we often ask this question hypothetically. It's like, well, before the universal bestowal of thought adjusters, bestowal of the Spirit of Truth at Pentecost, how many people had adjusters? Okay. We're a far cry 2,000 years ago from a world that's where the races are blended and we're biologically fit, et cetera, where you would now have a majority. Right? So it seems to be saying it was probably a distinct minority on the planet prior to Pentecost, prior to 2,000 years ago, on this, that had adjusters. So, you know, and you're talking about a combination of those who would get one temporarily and be spirit fusers, because they're still effectively primitive mortals. Those who actually can fuse eventually, and got that adjuster because their parents had adjusters, so they got one automatically at roughly age 6, and those that, as adults, chose, you know, more consciously. Remember those prerequisites of adjuster indwelling. There's, you know, they kind of go from very full-on conscious sort of choice to very unconscious choice. When they say choose here, right, don't think just conscious choice. I mean, it's a whole spectrum, you know, including unconscious choice.
Do you think most of the apostles got them?
Right. The apostles, you can tell, did, because Jesus refers to them as having souls. Okay. Yeah. You know, I would think they were treated like reservists, probably, see, and they got an adjuster like a reservist.
Even the Alphaist ones.
Right, even the Alphaist ones. You know, kind of foreshadowing Pentecost, see, really, you know, them getting adjusters like that. Yes, but here you see, you know, they're reminding you that even if everything is going normally, a lot of the individuals on a world are not, you know, they're not as they appear. They appear to be a being that is part of eternity as an individual, but they're not really. They're actually part of the evolution of the whole. They're part of the evolution of the supreme. They're temporary lumps in the supreme, you might say, very dismissively, but that's the reality. You know, they're just reminding you that, and even at this stage, it's still relatively early, and a lot of what's going on is not producing individuals as individuals get to eternity. They're part of the evolution of the whole, still in the grand universe. You know, so that's a very startling statement. You know, you're thinking this is
politically incorrect.
You're thinking this is pretty advanced, and then they say during this epoch the majority is like, are we talking 51%? Or what are we talking here? You know, it may be better than that, but they are, just by saying that, reminding you that, you know, you go back a little ways and it's a minority. And so obviously for us, Jiminy, it must have been, you know, a distinct minority, I guess. With the only kind of asterisk is, like we always say, there are, you know, the fact that a lot of us, because of the rebellion and default, were primitive effectively, and spirit fusers, you know, maybe there was more than you'd expect that got adjusters for reasons that even the revelators don't understand the causality of. Right, and we're going to be spirit fusers rather than father fusers, you know. So maybe it's not as minuscule as you might imagine, but still, you know, it's hard to imagine it was over 50% if this is the case here, right? So,
is there any average number of spirit fusers on each world? Is there?
They never really give you any sort of, you know, statistics of that. I mean, other than, you know, pre-planetary prince, when it's, you know, directly primitive man, most are spirit fusers.
You have a certain amount of time for that, usually. Mm-hmm. And our planet's not like it. I mean, we've got this long bell curve of, you know, mishaps and stuff. Yeah. I just thought if there was kind of an average of spirit fusers, then they would allow for that somehow to be made up.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of the things you could speculate is, you know, them creating the Andonites, you know, before the Sangiks, so that you have 500,000 years instead of a much shorter period of time where you basically just are going to have spirit fusers. See, in a way, that kind of makes our world a little bit like those worlds that only have spirit fusers.
Yeah, because
we got this extended period. So, so that's why I say, thinking that way, that in some ways we're kind of a quasi-spirit fuser world, you know, like some worlds are totally, maybe that would argue that that we had a higher percentage of individuals with adjusters here prior to Pentecost than you would speculate if you didn't have the Andonites. If it was just a world that had just Sangiks and went into rebellion and default. But anyway, just speculation.
Because they allowed the spirit of truth and universal thought adjusters.
Yeah.
Just before we were really ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was where I was going to go next. I mean, that contrast. See, flip it around now, you know, and recognize, is it surprising that we have a lot of difficulties on this world? I mean, you literally have a lot of people on this planet that under normal conditions would be considered primitive, right? And would be, you know, they would only have a virgin adjuster, so there would be the most minimal of potential disruptive stimulus, you know, that could throw them off on some tangent. You know, they can, you know, ignorance is bliss. When it comes to working with energy that's dangerous, but we've got all of these very limited biologic individuals that now get adjusters automatically.
Yeah, and experience.
Yeah,
right. And advance their supreme ones at that, right? So, you know, when you think about it that way. Now, when the revelators say, you show a surprising willingness, you know, for instance, that one passage, you know, I'm paraphrasing, you know, to fixate on your unity consciousness and go off on the tangents that you do. Well, is it really that surprising? You know, when you give individuals where it's not safe, right, normally, all of this potentially not well composed, incorporated influence, you know, impose that upon them. Is it really surprising that they may go off on tangents of bias?
If you're going to do that, it shouldn't surprise you that they have to be advanced or to be able to handle
right.
that.
Yeah, is it surprising that a world like ours would have, we would turn every idea into an ideology, into an ism, right? We would falsely exalt a part into a whole. No, I mean, it's just going to be inescapable, right? You've got individuals that can't even remotely encompass the whole. And so the tiniest part will seem like a whole to them, appear like the whole to them, and they'll consider it a complete lifestyle solution. They'll stick an ISM suffix on their idea, and off they'll go. Right? So we have everything-ism, you know? It's this, that, and the other-ism. Everything's an ism.
Isn't it pretty unheard of?
I thought everything was a new syndrome. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how often does it happen on any world in Nevadon that planet in this state gets a full complement of adjusters of that quality?
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't everything be a surprise?
Yeah. See, so that's what I wanted to kind of, you know, think about the corollary that's being between the lines of that paragraph. See, to understand a little bit why things are getting so dicey here. We have all of this influence towards ideals, but we're clueless. We don't have any wisdom to go along with that intense desire. And so we grab a hold of anything that's really false, call it true, and off we go. You know, we can't even make an ab buster without the commercial for the ab buster somewhere in the commercial saying that it's a complete lifestyle solution. I mean, everything we turn into an ism, the most trivial thing, right?
Energy efficient light bulb.
And that's what sells. You know, if somewhere in the commercial it effectively says it's a complete lifestyle solution, right, they'll sell millions of them. Because everyone wants a part to be a whole. Right? Yeah, okay, so that's where we are. Or aren't, yes. All right, so, yeah, so just, you know, appreciate that, that they're, what they're talking about there is, you know, when they say choose, is that you have an awful lot that aren't getting it automatically. I mean, some of that majority they're talking about, right, are children that are getting it automatically at roughly age six because their parents, one of their parents had an adjuster, right? But there's an awful lot that isn't automatic. Right? None of us have to even unconsciously choose now to get an adjuster post-Pentecost. It's just given to us automatically now.
Tremendously risky of Michael Devedon to just...
Yes, but it appears to us it was tremendously risky. Like I always joke, you know, when he decided to skip the magisterial son and skip fixing all of the rebellion default stuff and just, you know, come here as a bestowal son. And I'm sure there was just countless quintillions of beings on high that said, are you sure you want to do that? Is that wise? Do you know how they're going to squirrel off on tangents? Do you know how many isms are going to be formed on that world? Right. Do you know how many people are going to go out in a delusional blaze of glory, you know, on that world? Right? Yeah. Yeah. So, buckle up.
The main reason for him to do that, because he knew people were going to make those choices. So he was saying, well, if they're going to make poor ones, let's get it done.
Well, and again, remember, there's, you know,
like it says, the whole bit, to do the same thing.
Right. The whole bit about, you know, is it wise? Nothing of survival value is ever lost, independent of any choice or decision that's made anywhere in the universe of universes. If something genuinely has survival value, it can't be lost. That's why it's not lost. If you see something that's genuinely lost, not just appears to you in your ignorance to be lost, but if you're pretty sure that something was genuinely lost, it's because it had no survival value, right? Something that genuinely has survival value can't be lost. That's why it isn't lost. There's a physics to the universe, right? It's not ruled by magic. It's not arbitrary. Oops, that just got lost arbitrarily. Nothing like, there's no arbitrary.
Yeah. See, I told you it wasn't wise.
It's 100%, you know, law and logic.
But there's a lot of it made up with what you were talking about earlier, lumps in the supreme.
Right.
It's not lost completely, but it's not individualized.
Right, it doesn't, that has value, but not survival value, not individuated value. I mean, it's part of the individuality of the whole. That part is not an eternal part. Yeah. Right. Now, you had something?
Could you call his role a disruptor?
Yeah, you can see how... You know, he has that wisdom that we've discovered. You know, when things get really kind of stuck, you know, we know that someone's got to come in and, you know, if a corporation is just hopelessly bogged down in bureaucracy, someone's got to come in there. You got to have a disruptor CEO come in and break the thing and to get it moving again, right? It's obviously that tough love sort of a thing. You know, that's being implemented here. There's a disruptor thing. You put that infinite disruptor in everyone's mind that is that fragment of infinity, that adjuster, and it's going to disrupt some things. Some are going to go, like I said, are going to go out in a blaze of glory. All right.
During the closing ages of this dispensation, society begins to return to more simplified forms of living. The complex nature of an advancing civilization is running its course, and mortals are learning to live more naturally and effectively. And this trend increases with each succeeding epoch. This is the age of the flowering of art, music, and higher learning. The physical sciences have already reached their height of development. The termination of this age, on an ideal world, witnesses the fullness of a great religious awakening, a worldwide spiritual enlightenment. And this extensive arousal of the spiritual natures of the races is the signal for the arrival of the bestowal sun and for the inauguration of the fifth mortal epoch.
Okay. Notice one of the things that probably jumped out at you, because we've been talking about it so much, they used the word naturally there. You know, and we've been talking so much about that contrast between, you know, the endless cry that humans have to go back to nature, you know, and it's like, no, the universe is mind-made and personality-managed. The whole point, our destiny, is a completely artificial universe of universes, an art form, right? Artificial, art-like, right? It's a personally managed thing. So what do they mean here by live more naturally and effectively? Okay, if you reflect on that,
don't panic, go organic.
you can see why. You can see where the human interest in the word natural comes from. Okay, there's a truth to our thought. You know, when I've been challenging that over and over for, you know, months on end. I was challenging the factual expression. I wasn't saying there wasn't a truth behind people's desire, intrigue about the word natural. It's just that what they need to recognize is the naturalness that you want to synchronize with is not what's natural for an animal origin. Don't synchronize with the bottom, synchronize with the top. Right, if you use the hourglass analogy of your mind, right, the cosmos is interfacing on the top, you know, and just the basic animal nature is interfacing on the bottom. Right, you don't go back to nature. You go up to a transcendent nature, the nature of the cosmos. What's the nature of the cosmos? The physics of the cosmos. The word cosmos means universal harmony. Right. What they're talking about is, you know, beginning to have the wisdom, insight, and foresight because of this philosophical uplifting, so that you can begin to see how you how so many of your institutions and mores are not cosmic in character. They're fraught with ignorance, and ignorance is always produces, like I was just saying a minute ago, elaborate wheels within wheels, bureaucratic nightmares. Right, all kinds of complexity that's not necessary. Right, and everyone is dutifully conforming to all that complexity for ages, until they finally go, wait a minute, there's a much more efficient way to do this. Why do we have all of this complexity? It's not necessary. You know, you finally can penetrate through the fog of that, and you can see you can do the exact same thing in a much simpler way. Right, I can get the solar system by putting the sun at the center and have everything go on just one clean elliptical orbit, instead of putting the Earth in the center and having to have Mars, you know, go around the Earth on a cycle and then an epicycle on that cycle and an epicycle on that epicycle and an you know, ad nauseum, right? In order to get the motion of Mars across the sky, I had to do all these. It's like someone finally had the insight, say, "Oh no, cut through all that folderol. Just put the sun at the center, right?" And now you got the same thing. Mars takes the same path in the sky that you observe, only it's a much simpler system, right? Occam's razor begins to come into play in a philosophic age like this. People begin to cut through the silliness, right? And see, and you do things more like the cosmic harmony, which is perfectly efficient. There's no waste anywhere, you know, in the overarching fact of the cosmos.
Though they do say that tilling the soil, even on advanced planets, is like the job.
Sure, so right. There's always that. Right. You never, you know, in this life, perforce you serve two masters. Right. So again, we're not talking about severing ourselves from the earth, right? Getting so heavenly minded we're no earthly good. Right? We got to stay grounded. There's no way to get into relationship with the inherent groundedness in the cosmos if you deground yourself on Earth. Right? That's the fundamental reason that you stand on dirt. That's why the Universal Father stands on the absolute dirt, the absolutum of the Isle of Paradise. He's grounded, right? As above, so below. So that never changes, right? But it's just, that's just kind of what's, think of it more, that's your relationship to material. The word natural should be lifted up to a higher thing. Instead of making material and natural synonyms, make natural and cosmic synonyms. You know, the actual nature of reality is a triunity. It's not merely material or merely spiritual or merely intellectual, for that matter. Right? It's a triunity. That's what's natural. Right? So that's what they're getting at there. All right. You know, and see how they mentioned art, music, and higher learning. Remember how they mentioned it before that you were presaging that at the end of the Adamic Age. There develops new interest in art, music, and literature, you know, they said back there. Okay, so what's this whole bit about the termination of this age on an ideal world witnesses the fullness of a great religious awakening? Okay, once you actually begin to synchronize with truth, once you have a personal living philosophy in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind, once you've had a symmetric synchronizing with the three levels there, tied to the three cosmic intuitions, you have cosmic individuality, associativity, and unity, encompassed in a triunity. Once you have that, you can now have a true religion like you could never have before. Until you have truth, you can't have true religion. True religion exists in the context of pre-existent relationship to truth. That's why you call it true religion. Religion. Technically, all religion before that is false. Right? And remember those three levels up there. The sixth level of meaning is the genuine spiritual level, not the apparent spiritual level down on the second level of meaning, right? The level of feelings. Spiritual and feelings are not synonyms. Right? Genuine spiritual is that four levels up on the sixth level. That's what they're talking about here. See, in the context of a full relation to your human nature in the upper domain of the analogy of your mind, now there's a possibility to focus in on that genuine religious consciousness on the sixth level of meaning, the genuine spiritual level, and have an awakening of the full potential of religion. Right? You've got to get full, you know, so you have to go up, you know, and get the whole of philosophy and then come back down again, right, and make science true and religion true. And so you follow the initial threads up and then take a hold of the wholeness above and then turn yourself and reapproach everything that you've approached before, but now from the top down instead of the bottom up. Lift religion up into truth, into relationship with the whole. Awaken that. See, that's what the bestowal son comes to foster. See, is that true religion? But as they point out, I mean, he couldn't do that because, see, I mean, even the budding nature of philosophy that we had at the beginning of the 20th century, we've now thrown away. And we've gone into just abject falsehood. You know, almost everything, every scientific theory and everything has gone off the rails. Most people don't even believe in philosophy anymore. They think it's mere opinion and they reject it. And we are just so not ripe to even utilize what Jesus tried to give us. Okay. All right.
On many worlds, it develops that the planet is not made ready for a bestowal sun by one magisterial mission. In that event, there will be a second, even a succession of magisterial sons, each of whom will advance the races from one dispensation to another until the planet is made ready for the gift of the bestowal son. On the second and subsequent missions, the magisterial sons may or may not be incarnated, but no matter how many magisterial sons may appear, and they may also come as such after the bestowal son, the advent of each one marks the end of one dispensation and the beginning of another.
So we talked about that up front. I mean, even if you have 20 magisterial sons, everyone is a distinct dispensation. And as we'll see when we get into the post-bestowal son age is a very long time. Right? And the bestowal son lives and dies. It's just a human life. It's just a very short time. That very long age can be divided up into many dispensations of magisterial sons. See, so think about actually what Michael did in coming here as the bestowal son before we got a magisterial son. You normally in a world have some before and some after. He just shifted it so there's zero before and they're all going to be after. That's the variation that we are. All of our magisterial sons are going to be post-bestowal son instead of some before and some after.
It says that each of whom will advance to races. I thought it was one race at this point. It was one. It was all blended.
Yeah, I mean, that they mean, as they'll mention later, I mean, you still have separate nations if because of geography, if nothing else.
Okay.
Right? And so, you have effective races. You have the people of that nation and the people of that.
Racist.
Right. And so they're using race. Again, it's just like when they said that they're still going to do things about fit, making more fit. And it's like, well, didn't they say initially that everyone was biologically fit? It's all relative, right? Right. The coarse races are gone, right? You don't have any of the pure line sanguine races anymore.
That's what I was
saying. Right. But, it's kind of like here. Right, we don't have any of the pure line sanguine races anymore either, but we kind of still have races. I mean, you've got the three secondary sanguics. You basically give you an effective race of Negroid peoples, and the three primary sanguics effectively give you a race of Mongoloid peoples, and then the primary sanguics with a whole bunch of Adamic blood thrown in, give you Caucasoid. Right. See, so we have quote-unquote races, but not races in the sense of sanguic. Right? So that's what they're just pointing out. I mean, you've blended, but you haven't homogenized.
Okay.
Just because it's blended doesn't mean it's homogenized. Yes. That's the key. So there's still lines, there's still strains. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
These dispensations of the magisterial sons cover anywhere from 25,000 to 50,000 years of Urantia time. Sometimes such an epoch is much shorter, and in rare instances, even longer. But in the fullness of time, one of these same magisterial sons will be born as the paradise bestowal son.
Okay, so, he kind of, like I said, you've got this whole span of magisterial sons, this much plus the post-bestowal son age time, which we'll see it can be from 10,000 to 100,000. And you just, the bestowal son is somewhere along that spectrum of years, and he's just shoved it. So he kind of just shoved it, forward 25 to 50,000 years in that whole span is what he effectively did. And we're just going to have all the magisterial sons doing their stuff post-bestowal. That's the difference on our world. They have to do all of their philosophic uplifting when you've already juiced everyone up totally spiritually with the spirit of truth and thought adjusters, rather than starting out before that where it's a little less volatile, right? These magisterial sons have to work with a full flammable phenomenon, right? And so they'll need lots of finesse, to guide us forward well. Help us to not go flying off on tangents and going out in a blaze of glory, like I said.
It's like trying to affect this orderly or somewhat orderly evolution with the gas pedal all the way
yes,
down.
Exactly. Yes.
You know?
Yeah. 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 Teaching a kid how to drive, say, okay, yeah. Get into the car. Step one, turn it on. Step two, push the gas all the way to the floor. Yeah. Okay, and while we're going 150 miles an hour, let me teach you how to gently steer, you know, and then how to corner.
The Supreme needs this.
Right, that's what we're doing.
It needs this extreme bell curve thing going on this planet.
Well, if he steps on the gas and it's in neutral, he's kind of safe still.
Yeah, right. Unfortunately, there's just enough andite floating around that no one is in neutral, right?
You know, and, no one's in neutral.
Yeah, that's the problem. Remember how they talk about that? That was the thing, you know. Got everyone out of neutral, that little bit of Adamic blood, but not enough to wisely steer the vehicle. So everyone just went racing towards the horizon, right?
You know. Got the horse and the wheel.
Step on it.
God's steering out of control car.
All right, let's read some about the post-bestowal son here.
Post-bestowal son man, number 5. When a certain standard of intellectual and spiritual development is attained on an inhabited world, a paradise bestowal son always arrives. On normal worlds, he does not appear in the flesh until the races have ascended to the highest levels of intellectual development and ethical attainment. But...
Big but.
On Urantia, the bestowal son, even your own creator son, appeared at the close of the Adamic dispensation. But that is not the usual order of events on the worlds of space.
You kind of tongue-in-cheek understatement there. So just to emphasize that highest, see, not high, but highest levels of intellectual development and ethical attainment. How far removed were we from that, right, 2,000 years ago? Yeah. So you just pour gasoline on. Yeah. Like we were saying. All right, keep going.
When the worlds have become ripe for spiritualization, the bestowal son arrives. These sons always belong to the magisterial or havonal... Avonal. ...order, except in that case. Once in each local universe, when the Creator Son prepares for his terminal bestowal on some evolutionary world, as occurred when Michael of Nebadon appeared on Urantia to bestow himself upon your mortal races, only one world in near 10 million can enjoy such a gift. All other worlds are spiritually advanced by the bestowal of a Paradise Son of the Avonal Order.
Right. And just notice how they wanted to be precise there, you know, and said near 10 million. Remember, it's roughly 1,000 inhabited worlds in each local system. Right? And then times 10, times 100, times 100. Right. So it's, you know, it's somewhere in the ballpark of 10 million. Sure enough, we are, you know, and it's not, you could say, oh, well, isn't that convenient that someone wrote a book where this happens to be the planet, you know, where Michael came? Well, you know, it's not a posteriori reasoning, you know, very convenient reasoning. He came to this world because it's one of the rebellion worlds. It's, you know, it's really 1 in 37 shot, not 1 in 10 million. It's a poster child of opportunity because it's a decimal world and all these things. But because of that, because he juiced it up like that, it's not at all surprising, like we've been saying, that we would get this thing. You notice how it's getting difficult and everyone is really kind of getting pretty intense in their zeal. Wouldn't it be wonderful if he had some help in finding the wisdom to put a bridle on that zeal and steer it well?
Rather than
using some material means and dumbing yourself down, right? You know, we've got enough useful idiots the way it is. Right? I mean, we need to go up, not down, right, to solve this problem. Right? We're in a difficult transition phase between very passive worker drones, you know, and enlightened, genuine humans. And you can't live in that in-between zone. Right? There's no stable beings that have just six of the adjutants. Right? You either have five or seven. Right? And that's where we are right now, effectively. You know, we've got a lot of people that are responding to their religious impulse, their sixth adjutant. Like we said, they're turning everything into an ism. Everything is a quasi-religion. Ab busters are a quasi-religion. Right? I mean, everything's is treated with that religious impulse. But is anyone using the philosophic impulse? Is anyone responding to the seventh adjutant? Right? No, they're trying to live in the unstable in-between. You need to go up. You need to respond to that philosophic impulse, and you need to follow it. Begin to develop the wisdom to regulate such a powerful energy as the sixth adjutant in your mind, that energy of zeal. If you don't, it'll tear you and everyone around you apart. Right? You need a governor. You need the seventh adjutant, an internal governor. You know, and plus that seventh adjutant is the doorway to actually synchronizing with the cosmos instead of just, you know, falsely exalting some notion on the, you know, down here on the plane and calling it the cosmos. All right.
The bestowal sun arrives on a world of high educational culture and encounters a race spiritually trained and prepared to assimilate advanced teachings and to appreciate the bestowal mission. This is an age characterized by the worldwide pursuit of moral culture and spiritual truth. The mortal passion of this dispensation is the penetration of cosmic reality and communion with spiritual reality. The revelations of truth are extended to include the super universe, entirely new systems of education and government grow up to supplant the crude regimes of former times. The joy of living takes on new color, and the reactions of life are exalted to heavenly heights of tone and timbre.
So doing that color, tone, and timbre, what are they playing off of? Remember what precedes this, art, music, and higher learning. Remember, see, that's why they're using that analogy, right? Using those metaphors because of what they said gave you before.
They use them in the celestial.
Right. They use them a lot. But just noticing the immediacy. See, they're playing off of what they told you was the precursor, see? All right, so, I mean, all that we've basically been talking about here, you notice, well, that wasn't our world again. Let's see, a world of high educational culture, even in carefully selected family in Palestine, were young girls being educated, right, all these things. We had almost no education. How many universities were on the planet, 2,000 years ago? It was a long time before Oxford and Cambridge. And encounters a race spiritually trained and prepared to assimilate advanced teachings. It's like, no, Jesus is like, oh my goodness, let's see, how can I possibly water this down so that they can give them anything at all? Let me think,
Let's burn Alexandria and we'll get rid of Zimboyden. We're in good shape.
Right. It's just, the contrast is so immediately obvious. Yeah, and did we appreciate the bestowal mission? No, we crucified him. Anyway, so this is, all right, see, this is an age characterized by the pursuit of moral culture and spiritual truth. And the really important thing is the visualization they gave you there in that next sentence. The mortal passion of this dispensation is the penetration of cosmic reality and communion with spiritual reality. Right? The mistake that everyone is making in trying to do something productive, effective, with what little glimmers of the fourth epical revelation are to be found in the New Testament, right? Or even what they're trying to do by reading part four in the fifth epical revelation, is they're skipping that first part. They're trying to just commune with spiritual reality. Right? And if you just try to do that directly, there's no truth to that communion. You know, you can do things that appear to be communion with spirituality, but it won't really be. Unless it's preceded by what they said, you have to penetrate cosmic reality, right? You've got the triunity, right? You have the spherical whole, right? And you have to penetrate inside of that triunity and synchronize with the unity phase within that triunity. I was kind of pointing out, again, if you think about the upper domain in the hourglass analogy of your mind, right? You have the whole of the upper domain. It's got a logical level, a moral level, and a spiritual level in there. You penetrate into the wholeness of that personal living philosophy and focus in on the sixth level and fostering a true religious consciousness founded upon the sixth level. But it's in the context of having the fifth and fourth levels, moral and logical as well, not merely spiritual. I mean, what do the Revelators and the Adjuster papers tell you about if you just jump in and fixate on the third cosmic intuition without the integrity of the three together as one, you'll take your initial religious impulse of your sixth adjutant down there in the second level of meaning. You'll juice it up on steroids with that third cosmic intuition, and you won't get some profound cosmic religion. What do the Revelators say in the Adjuster papers you get when you do that? Fanaticism. Right? You get someone flying off on a tangent and they're going to just explode, right? Right? Because you have no grounding with the logic of the first cosmic intuition. Right? And they just emphasized right here, you know, the worldwide pursuit of moral culture, right, and spiritual truth. Right? Right? I mean, you have to have the full. You can't just have the part. Right? So you have to achieve, which is a philosophic endeavor, what philosophy genuinely means is the relationship to the whole. Now, once you have the whole, now you can begin to work in there. You can focus on the individuality part and get true science. You know, get your science even more insightful and complete than before. You can penetrate in and get your religion, true religion. Not to mention your morality, true morality also. Right? But until you have the whole, none of those three parts can be true. It can't be true science, true morality, or true religion until there's true philosophy. Right? That you can penetrate, like they're saying there. That's the whole point. Penetration of the triune, the cosmic reality. And then you're focusing on that communion, that synchronizing with the unity phase in that triunity.
I thought you had to go above that. Yeah, I thought you had to penetrate those cosmic intuitions, mm-hmm. and then you had to go to the top and come out so that the personality encompasses yeah. it to make it the whole.
Right, right.
And then come back down. So I thought yeah. it was important. So I think of it as going up and...
Yeah, yeah, okay, so let's use that analogy. Yeah, so you're developmentally, you're moving up, and you get up to the sixth level in an initial engagement. But immediately, you then reorient, and you plant your feet in the cosmos, and start engaging the levels from the top down as you just worked through them bottom up. So if you've gotten all the way up to the top and you've turned yourself around, the very first level that you're going to deal with as you start to work your way down is the sixth level. That's what we're talking about. Immediately, once you've gotten all the way up, that the magisterial son helped you to do. The bestowal son comes and helps you with the first step of what you get when you turn around, right? Engaging the sixth level now, not from the bottom up, but from the top down. Religion predicated on the cosmos, not religion predicated on your big toe, your animal origin, right? And the level of fear, right? I mean, it's bottom
That's
up.
That's what I meant by an example.
Right, bottom up is the religion of fear. It starts with the level of fear at the bottom. Talking about getting up and having a religion that's predicated
that
on the cosmos.
Talking about the different levels.
Yeah.
In terms of the practical, I mean.
Right, that's the practical.
What does it mean,
and
experience.
Another way to talk about it that, you know, maybe is a little not quite as abstract,
okay.
is you know that bottom up you have religions of fear because that's where you start. You start with fear, and so everything is just fear and exalted fear and ever more exalted fear and fear and fear. Okay, until you finally get to the top. Okay, and remember how they say that you want to get to the point of having a religion of the spirit. Well, you start with a religion of fear, you get up a little ways, okay, and it starts to be more of a religion of the mind because you're kind of in the middle, right? When you actually get up to the spiritual level, the sixth level, right, it's not the spirit level, it's the spirit-like level, spiritual. Why is it called that? Because immediately above it, is genuine spirit energy on the outside of your mind. That's the interface where spirit energy is interfacing with your mind. When you actually get up to the top, you can engage the spirit that's on the outside, that's in the external world, and have a religion of the spirit for the first time. Another way to talk about what they're talking about here is the spiritual uplifter. We're talking about actual spirit substance, spiritual uplifter, getting a religion of the spirit, that other substance in the external world. Not something that inside that you call spirit, that's actually just fancy mind. Some fancy religion of the mind is not the religion of the spirit.
Not the spirit that lives in you either.
Right, not that either. Right? We're talking about genuinely synchronizing with spirit energy outside of your mind. In the same way that science is an effort to get the mind coordinated with the material energy in the external world. And we obviously tend to do that first because I can see the material stuff in the external world. I can't see the spirit substance in this room. And therefore, I believe it doesn't exist. And
or I don't know it.
Right, the key is to have enough, see, again, with this philosophic uplift, it improves your abstract reasoning abilities. You can recognize logically that there must be another substance in that external world because you're getting sensations in your mind that you reflectively discover that you know didn't come in through the material stimuli conduits. You're going, huh? Logically, there must be another substance in the external world, and I have another set of conduits where my mind is being stimulated by a unity substance instead of an individuality substance. You reflectively recognize that philosophically, and then you begin to predicate a religion based upon that recognition that you know there is another substance even though you don't see it, and that's what religion is genuinely about. Religion is not supposed to be about material and finding perfect arrangements of matter. It's supposed to be about that other substance. Science is about the matter. Religion, you finally discover, is about that other substance that I can't see yet. The next life, you'll be able to see the spirit substance in the external world. Right? It'll be a lot easier to create a religion of the spirit, you know, when you can stub your toe on it. But now you have to philosophically, reflectively, abstractly recognize that it's there, and that's what you're supposed to be directing that zeal towards. The ideals about that other substance, not the ideas about this substance, not ideas about matter. That's not what religion is about. It's about ideals that are tied to the other substance. Yeah. That's what they're trying to get you to here. All right, let's keep going.
The bestowal son lives and dies for the spiritual uplift of the mortal races of a world. He establishes the new and living way. His life is an incarnation of paradise truth in mortal flesh. that very truth, even the spirit of truth, in the knowledge of which men shall be free.
Right. So just, you know, we've already been kind of speaking to that. You know, they're playing off of that line in Hebrews, the New and Living Way. And fundamentally, you know, how are they, you see they're going to refer to it in the next paragraph too. Here they're saying, well, there's a truth to that statement. One way that that statement is true is that initially you just have three insights. You have an insight that's tied to individuality, an insight that's tied to associativity, and an insight that's tied to unity, the three cosmic intuitions in the Holy Spirit. When you get the Spirit of Truth, you get a fourth insight, an insight directly to the whole. The Spirit of Truth, truth is about the whole. So instead of just an insight into the three parts, and then you have to, you know, sort of transcendently synthesize that into a whole in order to get to truth, you now have an insight directly to truth, where you get a reality response that, you know, it's like, okay, is this the whole? Is this a proper synthesis of the parts? Is this genuinely a whole, or is this a false whole? You have an actual reality response where you get this feedback. Yes, that is actually a whole, not just an appearance of a whole. That's really a whole. Right? You have a direct insight. That's the, you have a new and living way to know when you're in relationship to truth, in relationship to the whole, directly, rather than synthetically and complexly, obviously. So that's what the point they're trying to make there. And then there's another way, like they say, that you can think of the quote-unquote new and living way.
On Urantia, the establishment of this new and living way was a matter of fact as well as of truth. The isolation of Urantia in the Lucifer Rebellion had suspended the procedure whereby mortals can pass upon death directly to the shores of the mansion worlds. Before the days of Christ Michael on Urantia, all souls slept on until the dispensational or special millennial resurrections. Even Moses was not permitted to go over to the other side until the occasion of a special resurrection. The fallen planetary prince, Caligastia, contesting such a deliverance. But ever since the day of Pentecost, Urantia mortals again may proceed directly to the Urantia spheres.
Okay, so you got this statement of fact. So there's another way, instead of just the truth, like they're saying, there's also literally, factually, there's now a way for you to ascend as an individual rather than having to wait for a group resurrection. Even a special, you know, resurrection, like, there, you know, like we often point out that Moses was part of. That Moses and a few, they wanted them to get to the mansion worlds ahead of the millennial resurrections or the dispensational ones. But the thing that they annoyingly don't explain is, what's the physics of this? Right? Right, that's left tantalizingly out of reach. But you can see one of the, it's pointing to, like I said up front. Remember how there's this definitive, unrecognized environment that we're in, energy environment, way beyond what we, you know, are aware of, and how it changes from dispensation to dispensation. And here's another thing: so they're pointing out that there's some literal physics that in order for you to be able to be taken as an individual, and you're going, well, wait a minute. I mean, if I die, okay, my guardian seraphim takes possession of this literal object that is my soul, right? And there's no travel ban. I mean, the seraphim can travel to the first mansion world, right? And I mean, so why couldn't I be No, they're telling you that there's some sort of energy linkage between the first mansion world and the resurrection hall there, and the world you came from that has to be in place, apparently. And that's not, you know, that circuit's not connected. So there, again, the whole physics of, you know, that we've talked about with the resurrection halls and exactly what's going on there.
It got disconnected.
Right, I mean, it's been disconnected, see, until Pentecost, until the planetary adjudication. You know, that's technically what, you know, Pentecost is about, the quote-unquote planetary adjudication, where some of the things from the rebellion were corrected. Just, you know, sort of a minimal set of things. All the individuals weren't adjudicated, but our planet was, to a degree. And, yeah, and so they turned this back on. And see, so it's just, it's all very mysterious. Exactly what the heck is this? You know, what does it do? Why, you know, who knows? But you know that they're talking about something literally, you know, they're talking about a physics. That's why they say procedure. Right? There's some technical issue here. All very mysterious. Yeah.
Shall we ask it contested?
I was just going to say.
Yeah.
Well, how dare he? Well, I mean, but so how was he? I mean, was it plugged in and then he was?
That's the mysterious. See, as I said, it's even more mysterious. Like, well, yes, but there wasn't individuals, but there were millennial and special resurrections. See, so you just get more confused the more you think about it. Like I said, I mean, the physics is impenetrable. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, maybe I'll get some incredible insight at some point and go, oh, hi, I see what... But right now, I'm clueless. I don't know why it is, you know, what switch was flicked, you know, but some switch was flicked, you know, and now you can move on as a, you know... So, you know, you had first circlers dying, you know, and, you know, and they were sleeping until, you know, maybe the dispensational resurrection, right? No. Okay.
Upon the resurrection of a bestowal son on the third day after yielding up his incarnated life, he ascends to the right hand of the universal Father, receives the assurance of the acceptance of the bestowal mission, and returns to the Creator Son at the headquarters of the local universe. Thereupon the bestowal Avenel and the Creator Michael send their joint spirit, the Spirit of Truth, into the bestowal world. This is the occasion when the Spirit of the triumphant Son is poured out upon all flesh. The Universe Mother Spirit also participates in this bestowal of the Spirit of Truth, and concomitant therewith, there issues the bestowal edict of the thought adjusters. Thereafter, all normal-minded will creatures of that world will receive adjusters as soon as they attain the age of moral responsibility of spiritual choice.
Okay, just quick little set of bullet points there. And so, you know, we kind of talked about, you know, you have this literal resurrection, as it were. I mean, this... You know, this being is different afterwards than before, like we were saying. So he's being, you know, reconstituted, you know, without the incarnation, but with this fused Marantia nature, this soul, you know, as part of him. You know, so it is a quote-unquote resurrection in that sense. You know, and ascends to the right hand of the Father, you know, quote-unquote, right hand of the Father, you know, the eternal Son, right? I mean, you're talking about that linkage between a magisterial Son and the eternal Son. Now, they have that very definitive link. That's why they're called sons, right? You know, so there's, you know, via the eternal Son, you know, he's touching bases there. He comes back to Salvington, in our case, you know, the local universe headquarters. And like we said... Ah, yes, the tenth set of worlds, right? probably their headquarters. They pour out the Spirit of Truth. Remember how that works? Once the Creator Son has his seventh bestowal, the worlds that got a Spirit of Truth before we did, right? Those all those get kind of upgraded to be the full-on one from the Creator Son, like we have. So ones like they're talking about here get upgraded. You know, and way you think about that is it's a Spirit of Truth, but it's a little bit more specific to that world. you get a spirit of truth that's more generalized to the whole local universe when it gets upgraded relative to the Creator Son. Showing you the truth of that line in the Bible about, pour it out upon all flesh. And the way that's factually the case is, remember, like they're saying there, the Universe Mother Spirit also participates in the bestowal of the Spirit of Truth. Right? A Creator Son or a Magisterial Son is not ubiquitous. They're localized. Right? They can't pour out something, on all flesh, quote-unquote. They can't pour it out ubiquitously. They aren't ubiquitous. She is. Right? She's ubiquitous throughout the entire local universe. Right? And so that ministry is poured out upon her spirit energy substrate. Right? And that's how it gets upon all flesh. That's how it can be ubiquitous. So it's not just ubiquitous, some sphere around a world or something. It's throughout the whole local universe. Right? So that if I leave this world, I'm still connected to the Spirit of Truth anywhere, within the local universe. And of course, remember, I actually can technically be connected even outside of the local universe because the mother deity of the super universe is related to that, right?
But in this case, he's only pouring it out to that particular world that the guy came from.
Yeah, it's just to that world. But when those individuals leave that world and they go to their to the mansion worlds, they don't get unplugged from the Spirit of Truth. See?
Yeah. It's a little tethered.
Yeah, it's everywhere. All right, let's see, and then what else? You got the universal bestowal of thought adjusters in, because now an individual doesn't have to get up to third circler. They can be a third circler. The Spirit of Truth bridges the gap between seventh and third, right? So you get the universal bestowal. And, but remember, of course, we're just talking about they have to be genuine humans, normal-minded will creatures. Subhumans aren't going to get anything. And then here's a good place where you can remind you that, the age of moral responsibility, right, the age of spiritual choice, it's not, don't think of it as some conscious moral choice, that commands the adjuster to come to you. Right? This is just given to you by grace, right? The age of moral responsibility is roughly age 6 when you're encircuited in the Holy Spirit and you have this second cosmic intuition, the moral discrimination. Right? Now you have a responsibility to obey the insight of that intuition. Before that, you obviously don't have a responsibility. You don't have any insight. You don't have any genuine moral insight. Right? And you can't choose, right? Because you're not a person, in fact, yet. You can make decisions, right? But you can't choose. Personality is spirit pattern. It identifies with your spirit encirclement. Now there can be quote-unquote spiritual choice. All right, so just, roughly age 6 out there. Just reminding you of there. Okay.
I thought you'd have to make some kind of choice or something.
Readers have always thought that. That's why I've tried to help people understand that. Right? You don't. I mean, that's pre-Pentecost thinking. Right, pre-Pentecost, you have to definitively, I have to climb up the third circle or something. That's all very conscious, very definitive. No, the laws have changed. Post-Pentecost, you still have all these people living as if it was pre-Pentecost, you get an adjuster by grace now.
Doesn't it say your first moral choice?
It does, right?
Okay.
Right. I was just trying to explain that. Right? You can easily overplay that. Okay. We can talk about that more offline.
If such a bestowal evanel should return to a world after the bestowal mission, he would not incarnate, but would come in glory with the seraphic hosts.
Again, just a little thing. What's the truth of that line in the Bible? They're not going to come in corporeal form. Come as a spiritual being. Right.
The post-bestowal sun age may extend from 10,000 to 100,000 years. There is no arbitrary time allotted to any of these dispensational eras. This is a time of great ethical and spiritual progress. Under the spiritual influence of these ages, human character undergoes tremendous transformations and experiences phenomenal development. it becomes possible to put the golden rule into practical operation. The teachings of Jesus are really applicable to a mortal world which has had the preliminary training of the pre-bestowal sons with their dispensations of character ennoblement and culture augmentation.
Right. So you literally have the proper teachings of Jesus now in part four of the book, but they're really applicable only to what? Well, there's some prerequisites, right? Do you have a philosophic mind, right? Character ennoblement and culture augmentation. I mean, you can't somehow force that upon the whole planet, but you have to develop that in you as an individual in order for those teachings to really have any way to relate to you, right? Because they have to penetrate a cosmic whole, right? You can't, you know, that's the truth of them. You know, that's the one thing that the midwayers, you know, give you in part four relative to, say, the New Testament, right? They say what Jesus never said. They use the word cosmic, cosmos, to remind you of what they're saying right here. Right? You have to have that cosmic whole in order for them to be really applicable to you. That's why, you know, when they tell you about first miler, second miler, they say, okay, you have all this earnestness of second miler relative to what's come down over the last 2,000 years from Jesus, and yet you still languish in moral darkness. Why? Right? Because you don't have the prerequisites. Right? I mean, what Jesus gave us is not magic. It doesn't go in and consecrate your mind and then uplift it. You have to get your mind consecrated first before it can uplift it. That's what we just read. The mind was uplifted, and then, right, this uplifter came. If you don't do that, that spiritual upliftment really doesn't do anything for you except maybe exacerbate your fanaticism. And that's the rub here. Let's see here. The other thing there, of course, is, we're post-bestowal sun age. I bet light and life is around the corner. The post-bestowal sun age may extend from 10,000 to 100,000 years. Take a deep breath. It's a long haul ahead. and like we were saying, on our world, when you had no precursors, I'll bet it's on the longer side. Probably. Yeah, right.
But if I step on the gas...
Right. See, you say, well, yes, but we have the spirit of truth and universal soul and thought intelligence. Yeah, so does every world normally. And it still can take 100,000 years. Right. So it's going to be a long time until light and life. Okay.
During this era, the problems of disease and delinquency are virtually solved. Degeneracy has already been largely eliminated by selective reproduction. Disease has been practically mastered through the high resistant qualities of the Adamic strains and by the intelligent and worldwide application of the discoveries of the physical sciences of preceding ages. The average length of life during this period climbs well above the equivalent of 300 years of Urantia time.
Go ahead and read the last one too.
Throughout this epoch, there is a gradual lessening of governmental supervision. True self-government is beginning to function. Fewer and fewer restrictive laws are necessary. The military branches of national resistance are passing away. The era of international harmony is really arriving. There are many nations, mostly determined by land distribution, but only one race, one language, and one religion. Mortal affairs are almost, but not quite, utopian. This truly is a great and glorious age.
Okay. That's all pretty straightforward. And we'll see in the next one, and they talk about our differences a little bit. It ends with a comment about what they're talking about here. This truly a great and glorious age, right? Really kind of beyond your ability to imagine, right? As should be pretty obvious from what we're just reading here. What would a world be like, if it was populated by genuine cosmic citizens like they're describing here, right? Everyone had the law that is the cosmos written in their hearts, like they're saying there at the end, and are basically self-governing, right? You don't need external things, right? That whole bit of going from a nation to a territorial state, where you have these external laws, like they're talking about restrictive laws, right? First you establish them outside, and then you absorb them within, right? And you become not just living love, but living law, right? And if you're equally living love and living law, you are cosmic, and you're all the more godlike, because God is love, yes, but also God is law. He's both the same. In his mind, there is no difference between love and law. He's an infinite being, and the apparent infinite separation between love and law is no distance at all. He brings those two things together as one, and there's a downstepped potential to do that, even as a finite being, to begin to have that cosmic wholeness that's law and love synthesized together as one. And so you see, obviously, as a spiritual uplifter, very definitively, love is going to be in your heart. And they're just reminding you at the end, and by the way, of course, that means law is also in your heart. Because we're talking about genuine love here, not some apparent thing, not something that you call love right now, that the revelers cringe to use the word L-O-V-E because, he's going to think that when I say this, right? No, we mean something cosmic, something profound, something transcendent, something that's so different from what you think of now that law and love could be the same thing, right? Remember, etymologically, legal and loyal are the same word, right? Can you get that, where legal and loyal are really the same word instead of opposite ends of a spectrum? Beings in a normal post-bestowal age achieve that. They achieve that relative completeness like that. All right. So we'll say, but there's your world. That's what we'll start next time. All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.